Welcome to this special presentation by Marshall Masters, a former CNN science feature producer and the publisher of the Colbrin Bible. You can learn more about this 3,600-year-old secular wisdom text at colbrin.com. That's K-O-L-B-R-I-N.com.
In this program, we're going to examine newly revealed historical accounts of the Exodus with a secular humanist view of the event. This alternate account of what happened during the Exodus was written by the Egyptians at about the same time the Hebrews were writing the Torah, or Old Testament. When it was first penned in ancient Egyptian hieratic, this account was called the Great Book. Originally the size of a modern encyclopedia, what remains of the Great Book has been merged with other texts. Consequently, down through the ages, this secular anthology has been known by several names. Today, we know it as the Colbrin Bible, 21st Century Master Edition, and its two abridged editions, the Egyptian texts of the Bronze Book and the Celtic texts of the Kol Book. When read in conjunction with the historical accounts in the Torah, or the Old Testament, a new picture of Exodus begins to form, and it shows us a very human view of what really happened during that event. This program will present this new evidence for you so that you can judge it for yourself. So join me now as we ask the question, did Moses use alien technology to part the Red Sea? Passover is the most important holiday in the Jewish faith because it is when Jews celebrate the Hebrew Exodus from Egypt some 3,600 years ago. Down through the millennia, this historic event has only had one real voice, that of the Hebrew Torah, or Old Testament, as it is known to Christians. This holy book tells us Egypt suffered the 10 plagues of Exodus as God's punishment for having a hard-hearted Pharaoh. Today, there is now a second voice, and like the Old Testament, it is written by the participants to this event, written at the same time as the Torah. It was first known as the Great Book. The reason for its coming into being was that Egypt's pantheon of gods had shown themselves to be impotent during the Exodus. This provoked a deep crisis, because the faith of the masses had always been the wellspring of Egypt's imperial power. To preserve power, the empire's religion had to be reinvented, using the monotheism of the Hebrews as its model. Hence the need for new knowledge. Written by Egyptian scholars and scribes, the Great Book contains the results of a first-ever regional anthropological study. Their method was to interview the wisest of the wise in all the various lands and culture within Egypt's sphere of influence. Their goal was simple. They were looking for any clues that could lead them to the one true God of Abraham. When it was completed, the Great Book was as large as a modern encyclopedia. But did the Egyptians find what they were looking for? Perhaps. After the Exodus, the son Pharaoh, Akhenaten, and his wife Nefertiti plunged Egypt into a monotheistic religious revolution. The high priests turned against them, and their revolution failed. Egypt then returned to its old ways, and during the reign of Ramses II, the days of imperial Egypt came to a close. Had Akhenaten and Nefertiti been successful in bringing a Hebrew-style monotheism to Egypt, the world as we know it today could be very different. Regrettably, only a fraction of the Great Book managed to survive the ages, and it is contained within the first 6 books of the Colbrin Bible. Now let's compare the similarities and differences between the Hebrew and Egyptian historical accounts of the Exodus, as we examine an alternate explanation of what really caused the 10 plagues of Exodus. The Kolbrin Bible and the Torah describe the physical events of the Exodus with the same level of vivid detail, and they share many commonalities. One that stands out is that both accounts explicitly avoid giving us the name of the Pharaoh of Exodus. While there is a popular myth that Ramses II was the Pharaoh of Exodus, there is no historical evidence to support that claim. Yet, it is curious that a key figure such as this would be wiped from history by both sides. Later in this program, we'll examine one possible explanation for this, and it could forever change the way we view what actually took place between Moses and Pharaoh. In the meantime, we need to focus our attention on the substantial differences between the Egyptian and Hebrew accounts with regards to how they interpret the same events. Unlike the Torah, which essentially documents a righteous victory for the Hebrew nation, the Kolbrin Bible tells us the same story, but from the viewpoint of the losers. While the Egyptian accounts were understandably tinged with a bit of disappointment and anger, their goal was essentially the same as that of the 9/11 Commission in America. They, too, had to answer the same questions Americans were asking right after 9/11. How did this happen to us? Why didn't we see it coming? And what can we do to prevent it from happening again? This is why their side of the story offers brutally frank reckonings that read like man-on-the-street TV interviews we often see on the nightly news. The Torah tells us that the 10 plagues of Exodus were God's punishment on Pharaoh for being hard-hearted. However, the Egyptians completely discount that view of history with a far more natural explanation. According to the Egyptians, the 10 plagues of Exodus were part of a global catastrophe that lasted for several months. They tell us this cataclysm was caused by the flyby of a massive object through the core of our solar system. It is interesting to note that they also attribute the Great Deluge, or what we commonly know as Noah's Flood, to an earlier flyby of this very same object. And they also tell us that it is unlike anything we'll ever see in the skies above. Described as being huge and reddish, it is also mentioned by other ancient civilizations as well. The Sumerians called it Nibiru. The Maya called it the Red Comet. The Druids called it the Frightener. And these are just a few. Like the Egyptians, the prophecies of these other civilizations also warn us this object will return in our time to wreak havoc once again. This far, we've learned that we have two historical accounts of the Exodus, and that the differences between the two offer us an entirely new historical canvas upon which we can now paint the story of Exodus. So let's use it to paint a different picture of what happened at the Red Sea. In the Kolbrin Bible, the Egyptians do not refer to Moses as a prince, but as a priest-prince, which is altogether different from simply calling him a priest or a prince. As a priest-prince, Moses had unfettered access to any place in the land of Egypt he chose to visit, such as a royal arsenal or a temple. Keep in mind that the secular chasm which first grew between scientists and theologists during the Renaissance, was totally absent in those times. In the time of Moses, a priest was both a scientist as well as a theologian, and what the ancient Egyptians called magic is what we now call science. A priest-prince, like Moses, would have had access to vital state secrets and devices. He would likewise have had unrestricted access to Egypt's mystery schools, where he would have learned how to use those secret devices. He also would have had unrestricted access to secret historical texts with their accounts of past events and prophecies of future events to come. Now consider this. Egypt during the time of Moses was not a third world banana republic by any means. In fact, it was the most powerful and technologically advanced nation of that time. And Moses, a Hebrew infant rescued by an Egyptian princess, grew up with the finest education and military training available at that time. So what would have Moses learned? He would have learned about the destroyer and the harbinger signs of its return. He would have learned about the alien technologies the pharaohs used to help build the pyramids as well. While some may balk at the notion that alien technology was used, how else can we explain a level of precision in the pyramids that cannot be duplicated with our most advanced modern technologies? So then, which is more alien? A historical fait accompli we could neither explain nor duplicate? Or the hubris of confining history within the straitjacket of our own limitations? Therefore, the similarities and differences between the Hebrew and Egyptian accounts we've discussed so far paint a far different picture of what really happened during the Exodus. With this in mind, I offer for your consideration this alternate explanation of what really happened. Thanks to the education Moses received in the mystery schools, he knew how to recognize the harbinger signs that would signal the return of the destroyer. And, as the old saying goes, in chaos is opportunity. Therefore, Moses knew to expect chaos that would come as a result of the impending flyby of the destroyer, and that he could use this global cataclysm to help free his people from bondage. Look at the pressure events like this would put on Egypt. If you have slaves, you have to feed them, and you need a military in order to keep them under control. During the chaos of a cataclysm, you need to feed your own populace, and you need your military at its full strength to keep order. It was an opportune time, because Egypt had more on its plate than the pharaoh could handle. So what it all boils down to is this. If you believe the Hebrew account of Exodus, then God punished Pharaoh for being hard-hearted. If you believe the Egyptian account, Moses shrewdly used a natural catastrophe to free the slaves. And if you go for the latter and not the former, here's where it gets interesting, because now it gets us to the point where we talk about what Moses and the Hebrews took with them from Egypt. Both the Torah and the Kolbran Bible tell us that the Egyptians gave the Jews gold and silver. However, the Kolbran Bible offers greater detail and says they also received precious gems and copper. In fact, the Egyptians handed over priest chalices, urns, and ornaments. Why did the Egyptians do this? The Torah says Moses instructed the Jews to ask for these treasures. However, the Kolbran Bible says the Egyptians gave these items freely because they feared the God of the Hebrews. This was a critical admission by the Egyptians, for in the midst of this crisis, the mainstream of Egyptian society saw their gods as bankrupt and impotent in comparison with the one true God of Abraham to which the Hebrews prayed. After Moses departed with the Hebrews and many Egyptians who chose to follow this rogue prince of Egypt, the Kolbran Bible tells us the Egyptian people begged Pharaoh to bring them back to Egypt. In the book of manuscripts, we're specifically told, he sought to bring back the slaves, for the people said their magic was greater than the magic of Egypt. So now we have all the peoples of Egypt freely giving the Hebrews treasure out of fear of their God, and then beseeching Pharaoh to return them to Egypt so that they too could enjoy the protection of this very God from the ongoing natural disasters caused by the destroyer. However, what Pharaoh did next turns all of this into sheer nonsense. By the time Pharaoh and his army caught up with Moses and the host he led, the waters of the Red Sea were parted, and the host was crossing a land bridge on the seabed. Instead of beseeching the host to return, Pharaoh and his army began slaughtering all of those in the back of the column. According to the Colburn Bible, those in the front of the column threw down their bundles and abandoned their carts so that they could run quickly to the far bank, where Moses watched the slaughter unfold. Those in the back of the column not only faced treacherous natural obstacles, they were further slowed by the baggage, carts, and livestock that had been abandoned by the host at the front of the column. Consequently, better than half of the Hebrews and Egyptians that walked out of Egypt with Moses were killed in a horrific slaughter as Pharaoh and his army frantically hacked and sliced their way across the exposed land bridge of the Red Sea to the far bank. It was then, the Egyptians tell us, that the waters returned and killed Pharaoh and most all of his army. They, like the corpses of the many they had brutally hacked to death, were then washed away. So now we come to the obvious question. Given that the Egyptians freely gave their most precious treasures to the Hebrews and begged their Pharaoh to return them so that they could enjoy the protection of the Hebrew God, why would Pharaoh commit such a heinous slaughter and thereby incur the wrath of the Hebrew God? It only makes sense if you as Pharaoh knew that what was really happening had nothing to do with a greater God, but rather a greater technology. Ergo, incurring the wrath of a greater God was a non-starter issue for Pharaoh. So then what could possibly explain why Pharaoh committed this slaughter on the exposed land bridge of the Red Sea? Simply put, alien technology. One that the Egyptians could have come by either by fortune or guile, in which they used to help them build the Great Pyramids. A device so powerful, it could be used for military purposes as well. Had Pharaoh, the most powerful man in the world, at that time, had come to realize that Moses had taken a state secret with him in order to ensure the survival of the Hebrews, he would have been hard-pressed to get it back or risk it falling into the hands of his enemies. So why did Pharaoh and his army perish? Moses, who had been operating this device from the far bank of the Red Sea, knew he had to act and deactivated the device, which up to that moment had been parting the waters of the Red Sea with a force shield of some sort. As implausible as that may sound, consider this. The Ark of the Covenant was built shortly afterwards, and it was designed as an electrical device of great power. The Ark was framed with acacia, a heavy hardwood that was used to build mummy cases in Egypt, because insects would not destroy it. This wood also happens to be a very effective insulator, and this acacia frame was clad inside and out by gold, which happens to be incredibly effective as a radiation shield. In fact, NASA uses gold to keep our astronauts from dying from radiation, and we couldn't have gone to the moon without it. Further to this, the physical dimensions of the Ark are reminiscent of the devices used to build early radar systems during World War II. The Ark was an electrical design, and theoretically, its immense capabilities could have been used to amplify the power of a small device by several orders of magnitude. When you're fleeing for your life, you need every advantage you can get your hands on. And that would have been a perfect reason for Moses to take this technology, to ensure the survival of the Hebrews during the arduous years following the Exodus. He knew he had to excise generations of slave mentality from his people. Armed with such a powerful weapon, he could keep his enemies at bay long enough for him to bring that about. Earlier in the program, I mentioned an interesting point in common between the Hebrew and Egyptian accounts of Exodus, and I believe it could explain in part why God punished Moses for losing his faith. But is that really what the story is all about? During the American Civil War, brother turned on brother. One would fight for the Union and the other for the Confederacy. And over the course of the war, such sibling pairings did cross bayonets on the battlefield. As strongly as one loves a principle, there is a greater love, and when the two are in conflict, the result can be memories that torment the soul until death. Yes, the Egyptians were brutal slavers, and this led to the events that caused Moses to flee Egypt. Yet, it is hard to stop loving, for this is a very human thing. As Moses stood on the far bank of the Red Sea, he witnessed a man who was his brother, a man from a family that had loved him unconditionally, and now, like the Civil War soldiers of the gray and blue, he was locked in a mortal combat with his brother. Before him, he watched with horror as his people, his blood, his lineage, being massacred, and so, as a patriarch, he had to put aside his own personal feelings and act. At the very moment he deactivated the force fields emanating from the alien device he'd stolen from the Egyptian royal family, he knew he'd sealed his brother's fate. Perhaps this memory haunted him throughout his 40 years in the desert, until the day finally came when Canaan, the land of milk and honey, was finally in sight. The Hebrew account tells us that at the age of 120, God chose to punish Moses for losing his faith, yet we're not told exactly why. All that we're told is that he picked Joshua as his successor. Then, after the Hebrews entered the Promised Land, he ascended Mount Nebo and died. And to this day, his gravesite has never been found. As with all history, there are painful memories we just as soon forget. Perhaps the given name of the Pharaoh of Exodus was expunged from the Hebrew and Egyptian account by mutual agreement. Moses, a priest prince of Egypt, honored his family by protecting their names from ignominy. Both the Egyptian and Hebrew accounts of Exodus give us horrific levels of detail about how Moses parted the Red Sea, and absolutely none about the exact manner in which he parted his life. Was it really God's punishment, or did Moses want the privacy of an anonymous death? When you consider that the burden of leadership often brings the responsibility for decisions too great for any one soul to bear, perhaps Moses chose to die alone on Mount Nebo, not as God's punishment upon him, but rather as a self-dictated punishment upon himself. Perhaps as he sat atop Mount Nebo, knowing his people had entered a new land to begin a whole new chapter in the book of life, he could finally lay down the mantle of responsibility and put himself right with his own demons. Demons that had torn his soul between a family that had once loved him unconditionally and his people.
We thank you for listening to this special presentation by Marshall Masters, a former CNN Science feature producer and the publisher of the Colbrin Bible. You can learn more about this 3,600-year-old secular wisdom text at colbrin.com. That's K-O-L-B-R-I-N.com.